a real conversation and some hard truths. Gangs, drugs, and guns. Giving a voice to those willing to sacrifice. We have stories that need to be told. We have lessons that need to be taught. Protect and serve. Welcome to The Quiet Professional. Hey everybody, welcome back. Nathan Rome is with you. Today, we are going to be talking about self-defense, fear, and mindset with Coach Tony Blauer. The coach is a world-renowned self-defense and fear management expert who has over 40 years of experience in the industries of martial arts, self-defense, and combatives. As the CEO of Blauer Tactical Systems, Coach Blauer heads one of the world's leading consulting companies specializing in the research and development of performance psychology and personal safety and scenario-based training for defensive tactics. The coach is best known for developing the world's first self-defense system based on the sciences of psychology and physiology called the Spear System, as well as the world's first dynamic scenario training equipment called High Gear. Coach Blauer also has a performance psychology program called No Fear, and that's K-N-O-W, No Fear, which helps people develop their mental and physical resilience. It's also now a podcast, so I hope people go and check that out, and we'll get the links up. So welcome, Coach Blauer.
Hey, great to be here, Matt.
Glad to have you on. The mutual connection is Matt Domiancic, so yeah. He got me hooked up with you. So I got to throw a shout out to him right off the top. He's a solid guy, and you just had him on your No Fear podcast as well.
Yeah, I've known Matt for 20 years. He actually, before he got into law enforcement and then got out of it and is now doing the mental health side of things. I met him 2 decades ago. I used to live in Montreal, Canada.
Yeah.
And he came up to an event there, and he was also just, he was fascinated with the fighting and the self-defense. And I think he was thinking about becoming a cop, and he talked his way into one of our law enforcement courses at, I was running at the original Smith & Wesson Academy in Massachusetts.
Okay.
And, he was just very persistent and open-minded, really good athlete. I said, okay, come on in there. And, we've maintained a friendship now for decades.
Yeah. I like when you have some of your guests on, and Matt's one of them, that you're always telling, like, stop flexing in the camera. If people don't know, Matt's a big guy.
Right. He's so...
and you make fun of him. It's pretty funny.
Yeah. Well, he's just the beast.
Yeah.
And it's inspiring, but I tease guys like that. Hey, you're making me look bad, put on some baggy clothes,
Yeah.
And people can't see us now, but I guess I'm in pretty good shape for 63.
Well, you know what, when I get this up, the episode, I'll have links to your website. People can check out all your content and your videos. Yeah, you're not a small guy by any means. And actually, and we'll get into talking about you, but I was just watching one of your videos last night where you were just talking about an officer who was involved getting stabbed with a screwdriver, and then he kind of did his defense and put his hands up.
Yeah.
I mean, you're quick.
Dalton in Ohio.
Yeah. Yeah, and just watching that, like, you got the fast twitch going on. Like, you're very quick on it. So, I guess we'll talk about all that, your background, like your connection to martial arts.
Sure. We'll go wherever you are, man. And just with respect to fast twitch, I want to insert this here for your listeners.
Mm-hmm.
That our SPEAR system, which is an acronym for Spontaneous Protection Enabling Accelerated Response, it's the only system in the world where, when you talk about defensive tactics or self-defense, like, all systems, and this is controversial and some people might hate me right away, but try to be open-minded as I explain this. Most systems, whether it's a cool acronym or whether it's an oriental name of origin, the focus is on the move from the system. This is the move I want you to learn. This is what we're teaching you in DT, like as a recruit.
Yeah.
Do these moves. Control and arrest and restrain, whatever the language, And here's your in-service, requalification in this. And it's learning moves and they're complex motor skills. And their origin is always from some sort of martial arts system. So it's a complex motor skill. The spear system is the only system in the world where everything we do is based on what neurobiology and kinesiology predispose the body to do. Mm-hmm. And then we interleave that with what we understand from neuroscience and psychology is how do we think under stress? What movements do we have access to? And so when you said, hey, you're pretty fast, you got those fast twitch muscle fibers going, well, everybody has fast twitch muscle fibers. And of course, some people are faster athletes than other, but you don't just have slow twitch or just have fast twitch.
Yeah.
The startle response, and this is interesting, the startle response, and there was a study done, and we just had talking about it a couple of weeks ago, where the startle response in the body, the fastest response, it goes eyes, head, neck, arms, torso, feet. So imagine like a bomb goes off or someone says, look out, or someone takes a swing at you. The fastest response is going to be your eyes. Then your head starts to move. And people can't see me, but just imagine yourself, mm-hmm. someone saying, look out, and your hands come up to cover your head. And, you don't want to get hit in the head. So you're kind of like pushing away danger. That's a fast twitch muscle fiber. It's a non-conscious movement. So everyone listening to this, think of a time you flinched. You walked into a spider web and you went, right? Or someone went, look out, or someone took a swing at you. And next thing you know, you were like entangled in some shitty clinch, but your hands were up grabbing their shirt or their collar or their head. Everyone's had that experience. That's the startle response. It's part of your survival system. The most important thing, and I recognized this in the mid-80s training, it was 1986, I noticed this. We were doing some isolation drills on sucker punches. And I noticed how, this is like back in VHS days, right? Like, you're on a camera on a tripod, big RCA camera with a big, and I noticed that every time I flinched, I never got hit clean. And I was always like this intuitive, like researcher. Mm-hmm. I go, what about this? So I was always doing these Socratic exercises with students. How would we solve this problem? And I didn't like, and of course, like anyone in martial arts, you tried to do, what boxing or taekwondo or jiu-jitsu or Wing Chun. And, I played and dabbled in all this stuff. But I, in 1980, created a drill called the panic attack, which has nothing to do with anxiety. It was at the time, the name referring to the emotion that people experience in a holy shit, what we call the jack-in-the-box sudden violent encounter, mm-hmm. right? The jack-in-the-box metaphor is, you hear the clown music, everyone listening should be familiar with the clown music. So you're walking towards some clown. And I gotta be careful because, we live in the cancel culture world where, but for 30 years I've been teaching cops, military, public safety, first responders, from firefighters to tier one, the direct action units, all over the world. And I would say, look, that's the bad guy. Now these days people go, you can't say bad guy. Okay. Because it might be a bad girl. No, we just say, literally I was talking to a group yesterday where the dysregulated individual that's trying to bite your nose off is referred to as the client.
Yeah. I've heard this.
Right. So anyways, I'm like, holy shit. It's like trying to remember, I shouldn't say this. It's like trying to learn and remember pronouns.
Yeah.
It's a whole thing where what I'm looking at is just predator prey. I've got you, as an active duty, a protector. You put yourself in harm's way for the greater good to protect the world. And my job, as a researcher for self-defense, defensive tactics, combatives, is to make you safer as quickly as possible, not to teach you a martial art, not to get you a black belt.
Yeah.
And I say that and it's controversial. People say, can I swear on your show?
Oh yeah.
Do we care?
No, hey, you're good.
like I got people that fucking hate my guts. They go, Blauer said this and Blauer said this. I'm like going, don't confuse real sudden violence with combat sports or martial arts. And I say that, I'm 63. I've been doing some sort of combat sport martial arts since I'm 7.
Yeah.
Right? So I started wrestling, and then I got into Taekwondo, and then I got into boxing. And then I was doing MMA before, you know, the first observation of MMA was, let's say, 1993, when the first UFC took place. Mm-hmm. And then we started talking about mixed martial art. And I'm not, for those people who are selective listeners, I'm not saying by any stretch that I invented MMA, not at all. But there were a number of Bruce Lee was a mixed martial artist.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Combine a few.
And anyone doing Kenpo in Hawaii like 40 years ago was a mixed martial artist. So there were lots of people like doing things going, well, you know, this kicking's not enough. Like if I get in this clinch, I want to learn how to take this guy to the ground, hold him there. So they started wrestling and judo. You blend. But my point being here, when I criticize the way we teach, mm-hmm. I'm not just some guy. I've been teaching 43 years. Teaching 43 years. How old are you?
Yeah, I'm 37.
I've been teaching 6 years longer than you've been alive.
Yeah.
Right? So I got people out there going, what are you? And I just say this going, like, I've been teaching 43 years. And my focus has always been, how do I make people safer? Mm-hmm. And so, but I've been a lifelong martial artist. So when I talk about the differences between complex motor skill or brain-based training, that is consistent with neurobiology, kinesiology, physiology, psychology, like this is making your operating system operate for you.
Yeah. Right?
Understand how the central nervous system of the body can almost become like the circuit board for the central nervous system of your self-defense protocol.
Yeah, you know what? And you bring up a whole bunch of good points there. One that I really would pick up on is, like you're talking about in defensive tactics training with police. I've gone through two police programs, one with the RCMP up here and then one with the Edmonton police. And the defensive tactics always kind of comes down to, okay, you do, you know, grab the wrist this way, and you're going to turn this way. And every time I'm thinking, like, because I've done martial arts and I've been in fights at, you know, school and in the schoolyard and stuff, it never goes like that. It's like, right. It is literally dog brain. And if you have some level of training, you might resort back to that. But at the end of the day, it is smashing the person. And it's usually as fast as you can to end the fight as fast as you can, because
right. You
don't want to take any more damage. So, how, you know, kind of the thought I've always had is like, how do we get our police training to match this? And obviously when Matt brought up you and I'm looking through all your content, I'm like, this guy's been on to something forever.
Protected.
Why are we not teaching this? And also the fear aspect, which we'll get into, but.
Yeah. So I got a bunch of answers. And again, you know, some of them are controversial and polarizing. You know, Force Science just released maybe 6 months ago, a study on the role of the startle response in gunfights.
Okay.
And Dr. Lewinsky, the founder who runs Force Science, messaged me privately and said, hey, you're going to like this. Here's the link. It supports, you know, what you've been saying. And I read it and I looked at it. And I said to my team, and I got a training team, a mobile training team. They're a blend of retired and active duty. And I said, this is great that they're doing this, but you know, like I've been saying this for 30 years.
Right? Yeah.
It was like 30 years. And I'm glad there's some white paper data for it. But, you know, we've had a gunfighting program. I was down at Fort Bragg on V9/11, training guys in the stuff that people are exploring now. Mm-hmm. So my thing is like, why, and everyone knows about us, why are, if I could time collapse your safety, and out of respect to, because I know you're active duty, should I use your real name when I talk right now? Real question.
Oh yeah, no, that's fine.
Okay, cool. I don't know what the,
yeah.
There was an Australian podcast, I just said it for your own personal safety. There was a podcast I did in Australia where it was, you know, an individual who was still part of the Department of Defense.
Oh, okay.
He just said, hey, like, I put this out there and I'm okay to do it, but I don't use my name.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, you're all good.
I didn't ask. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Thanks, Nathan. This is Nathan's address, everybody. This is where he lives.
But, yeah. People can follow me home. It's not hard to find
me. Right. And he's going to practice some of the stuff I teach him on the show today. If you, why isn't everyone teaching this? So it's interesting because I've done stuff for the RCMP 20 years ago. I've done stuff for Edmonton PD 15 years ago. And why is it, why are they doing either jiu-jitsu or Krav or pressure point or complex motor skill? And the, one of the reasons is this. Typically, the people who are in charge of defensive tactics are people who love martial arts, and they have an unconscious bias that drives them to show people what they're very good at. Mm-hmm. And so I did a lot of stuff in Texas for their SWAT teams. And like there was one place, it was really fascinating. One region was heavily influenced by boxing. And their STX, their final training exercise in graduating recruits was you had to last X amount of minutes in the ring, you know, just slugging it out, just like a gut check. Another region was all grappling. Another, so you know what ends up happening is the person who's in charge of DT has a level of autonomy that can say, you know, hey, we're going to focus on this.
Yeah.
And then they're usually good enough to persuade through violence of action in a training scenario. You know, so if I'm the really good grappler and I come in, I go, Nathan, I know you like striking, but check this out. And I double leg you and take you to the ground and you're squirming. And then I make you tap and you go, see, look, no broken nose, no broken teeth. We control the guy. Here, you know, I can put cuffs on with you here. Everyone needs to grapple, right?
Yeah.
And I love grappling. I'm just using that as an example that if I were the boxer and I happened to, you know, put on some gloves at a guy and I lit up the guy who was the grappler, everyone would go, oh shit, I guess boxing does work, right? So we end up, what you see is the same type of almost, a romantic relationship that we find in the martial art world, mm-hmm. You find that in defensive tactics. And it shouldn't be that. It shouldn't be, you know, I'm getting a kickback from this gun company, so I'm going to push this gun. It should be, what is the best weapon for this scenario?
Yeah, especially, well, if it comes to law enforcement and military, I mean, you also got to work around your equipment and everything else you're carrying and wearing. And that also doesn't necessarily come into play all the time with the defensive tactics. A lot of the stuff is just in a mat room, not necessarily wearing all that, right? It's a different consideration.
Yeah. Let me qualify something, right? Because my first love, I start off as a grappler.
Okay.
So I wrestled for many, many years before I got into Taekwondo and then got into boxing. So my instinct is to get close to somebody just from like, that's where I was trained at a young. So I love all that. But I also recognize that it's the last place I want to be in a truly violent encounter. Mm-hmm. And certainly if I'm outnumbered or outgunned or outweaponed or whatever. So the danger is this. If you predispose yourself to go to the ground because that's all you practice, that impacts some of your active situational awareness.
Yeah.
So you walk into a situation and somebody looks like they're getting ready to do something. And instead of you doing a, this is Sparta kick and backing out of the room, right? You immediately rush in and take the guy down. And next thing you know, you find out that like three other people in that room are bad guys too. And you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, like, you know, like even if you're with a 12 person SWAT team, mm-hmm. I mean, I have stories without mentioning units where in military, where guys from Ranger Battalion who were just doing so much grappling when they had some like resistance in like in a true CQB environment, would take the guy down and, you know, try to choke him out or mount him or control him on the ground. And there's like this is like a room clearing operation and you're on the ground. Like you've got 16 seconds to clear these 2-3 floors.
Yeah.
Right. And you're grappling. And so I had direct knowledge from people, cause I was training. And again, I'm choosing the words carefully here. I trained the, Forcecom, the people that are actually moving out. And they were, what they were doing is they were getting from the schoolhouse people that were rooted in this foundation of grappling.
Okay.
And so it would predispose you to do stuff. And this isn't, and I just want to say this, and this isn't me apologizing because of, you know, wokeness and pressure. You need to be a good grappler because you might slip on blood and guts. You might slip on, you're in Edmonton. Mm-hmm. I live in California now. It doesn't snow here. There's no ice here.
Yeah.
Right? So there are seasons up in Edmonton, right? So like, if you don't know how to do a smart break fall with gear on, if you don't know how to, if a guy takes you to the ground. So we always say you need to have some foundational skills in all the elements of a toolbox.
Yeah.
And I always say that because it sounds sometimes like I'm criticizing grappling and jiu-jitsu. I'm not. What I am criticizing is people who go, that's all you need. And that's prior bias.
Everything has its time and place, right?
Correct.
Before we get too far down the rabbit hole, though, I do want to kind of get your background a little bit, because just talking about you living in Canada, so if we could kind of switch to that. So where are you born and raised?
Montreal.
Okay, so Montreal.
Not French. My French is horrible. I was born there in 1960, and I lived there until 2007, I think. And then I moved to the States in 2007.
Oh, wow. Okay. So really not too long ago, but a little time ago.
Yeah.
What was it like? Like, what were you like growing up, and what got you into all this martial arts?
The proverbial origin story was, I was I was a good athlete, and there was a part of me that knew that I was a great athlete, but I had this insane level of fear anytime I performed. So I was a skier, I was a wrestler, gymnastics, tennis, football, baseball, any sport I got into, I got really good. And I knew I could hit the home run, but then I would go strike out.
Mm.
And I knew I could win this wrestling match, but then I'd lose on points. I knew I could win this race, this ski race, and I was a really good skier, competing at for my age bracket at the highest level you could, but I would always almost win, catch a tip,
okay,
you know, two gates from each line. And so, you know, it was almost like, Phil Mickelson is, I don't know where this popped in my head.
Yeah.
The name Phil Mickelson.
Yep.
So, you know, one of the best golfers in the world who always choked when it was like his big moment to shine. And so for me, in that same way, I had this toxic relationship with fear that always undermined my potential success. And it was awful. And it stayed with me. And then when I was about 12 years old, I'm walking home from a pickup game of baseball, and I'm walking alone, had a good game, maybe didn't strike out that often, got on base a little bit. I like always played well. It wasn't so. Some people, they'll go, you sabotaged yourself, but no, like I was in there.
Yeah.
But it was like if I was up at bat, I was going, don't strike out, don't let out the team, don't let down the team, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I always I talk about like, don't focus on the obstacles, focus on the openings, and that's something I teach now. Where if I was you know, mountain biking, I'd be going, don't hit that tree, don't hit that rock, watch out. I was always like, so it was negative navigation as opposed to,
yeah,
he's open here. And so I've totally redesigned. That's the whole no fear program now. Mm-hmm. Is how do you change your relationship with fear Because if you can change your relationship with fear, you can change your mind literally in the moment. That if you change your mind, you can change your day, you can change your week. And now suddenly your life is different. And it doesn't take away fear. It just, when you get a fear spike about anything, you now have an internal system to go, oh, I'm thinking negatively about a future event that hasn't even happened. I need to change that now, or I'm going to make this harder or fuck this up completely.
So you kind of would steer yourself into those obstacles, kind of like you'd steer yourself into the crash, is what you're saying.
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes, because you can't, like if I'm boxing with you and I keep going, watch out, he doesn't hit you, watch out, he doesn't hit you. Like, watch out for, oh shit, that was close. He almost hit you with that right. Okay, good thing you slipped it. Okay, he's open there, but watch out, he doesn't counter you. All of that chatter in your brain changes neuromuscular response time. Mm-hmm. It's too much. There is a weight of fear, a metaphoric weight and an actual weight of fear. When I give you good news, Nathan, you will stand up. You know, if you're waiting, let's say you were interviewing for a promotion at work. You really, really wanted it because it was like a career shift that like you were dreaming about. And now they're interviewing seven other people, other candidates. And then you get the call and you go, Nathan, hi, it's the board that's evaluating you. And you're like, fuck, come on, get on with it. Like, we interviewed six other candidates and you're like, come on. And nobody can see me. I'm acting this out, right? I'm in my chair listening and I'm going speed up. Like, you know, yeah. After deep consideration, Nathan, come on. We've decided to give you the opportunity. What do you do when you hear that good news? What do? You always stand up.
Yeah.
Think about that. You're listening to the show and you're waiting for the results of a blood test and then someone calls you back and the nurse goes, is this Nathan? Yeah. We have your results. You're like, come on. And everything's fine. You don't sit there, right? Like there's a moment after the news sinks in that you stand up. If you're waiting to get into college, if you're waiting to find out if you made the SWAT team, and so there's an elation, there's a physical movement where you stand up when you get good news. So I talk about the psychology of fear can slow you down.
Yeah.
Right. You can't get the proverbial flow state. You know, if you go into a house or you're about to do something with your unit and everyone's just going, what about this? What about this? But it has a negative thing. It's not about contingency.
Yep. Yeah. We get that all the time.
Yeah. What if we run out of ammo? Well, don't you have like another magazine? Oh yeah. Like a lot of it has to do with the energy and the question.
Yeah.
This is all the fear management stuff.
Was this a lot of the stuff that you kind of dealt with as a kid and kind of coming up through adolescence?
Yeah, but of course I had no system. So I was just like going, what's wrong with me? Like I thought I was the most scared person in the world.
At 12.
Right. Just, yeah, at seven, at 10, you just go like, it was always like, what if this happens? What if this happens? The bizarre serendipity of that all is, of course, as an entrepreneur, I've created a program that is changing lives and saving lives. You know, that I have professional psychologists who get trained in my no fear protocol because it works more effectively than academic psychology.
Well, and then you start a podcast, you've got a business, and you're CEO, you've been training people, you do all the speaking engagements. That's probably the biggest fear for a lot of people, the public speaking.
Isn't that crazy?
But so how do you get to that part though? So you're 12 and you're in Montreal.
Yeah. So I'm 12 years old and I'm leaving this baseball game. And the next year I'm going to high school, right? So it's my last year in elementary school. And these two kids are walking and they see me walking alone and they stop and they go, hey, kid. And I'm like, oh shit, there's like these two 15, 16 year olds that are calling me. And I thought like, oh, this is cool. Like older kids want to talk to me. And I literally, it was like somebody pointing an X on the ground going kill zone and then going, hey, come here, stand on this red X. I had no idea. I go running up to them like, yeah, hey, what's up? And they go, hey, is this where you go to school? I go, yeah. When are you coming to high school? Oh, next year. And there's a high school about 500 yards up the same road.
Yeah.
I point to it. I go, yeah, I'm gonna be going to high school next year. And they go, well, welcome to high school. And I look at them. I go, thanks. And one of the guys just grabs me and, pins me, gets me into like a full Nelson, holding my hands behind my back And the other guy goes, you know, he smiles at him. He starts doing this bolo punch, and they're going to like, you remember when Sugar Ray Leonard hit Roberto Duran with the bolo punch?
Yeah.
He starts to do this bolo punch, and I'm squirming and struggling to get out of this. And everything goes into, you know, you should know what this means, tachy psyche, right? The big fantasy neurological term for the slow motion. And as this punch goes in slow motion to hit me, I'm 12 and I think I'm going to die. Like 16-year-olds are way bigger and stronger than 12-year-olds in general, certainly back in 1972. I don't know what's in the water now, but kids seem way bigger these days. But this punch, as it's landing, I scream like in anticipation of, and here's the fear factor. It's happening in slow motion. And I think the impact, this is what I've visualized. I think the impact is going to break one of my ribs and it's going to puncture my lung and I'm going to die. Mm. Like that's what my 12-year-old mind saw right there.
Yeah.
And I screamed in anticipation of that level of trauma. And it was this blood curdling, like I was going to die. But I was wrestling. I was skiing. I'm an all-around athlete, working out. I was in really good shape. And so this guy has my arms pinned behind my back, and I'm trying to rip myself out of this hold. So my abs and my body were as contracted as they could be as a result of the fear and the angle. You can visualize that, right?
Yep.
And so you think of like body impact training for a boxer, a kickboxer, MMA guy, right? They're standing there with their hands on the ropes, but they're going, and somebody's like giving them like uppercuts to the body or taking a med ball and pumping it into the body to dump in their core. Well, I was as tight as you could be. The punch, I didn't even fucking feel it, man. It hit me, but I had screamed so loud in anticipation. But get this, and this is what I said earlier. Like I was always this like intuitive researcher. Even at 12 years old, I felt the guy's grip loosen dramatically when I screamed.
Okay,
brain immediately knew his intention wasn't to kill me. And so what I did is I screamed. My intuition said, scream again the same way. So I didn't even feel the impact. So it hits me and I feel this grip change. Like, fuck, we don't want to hurt this kid. We just want to scare this kid. Like some sort of like, that was the logic. And my brain put that together like in a nanosecond. Nathan.
Yeah.
And I screamed again the same way. And the guy behind me dropped me. Because, you know, and he wasn't obviously thinking, oh, you know, I don't want to go to jail for manslaughter. He wasn't thinking that. He was thinking, we're just scaring this kid. I don't fucking hurt him.
Mm-hmm.
And I fell down to the ground like a, you know, on my knees and my hands. And I'm holding my body going, and they fucking run.
Yeah.
They think they really hurt me. And I watched them turn the corner at the parking lot, and there's a tree line there. And as soon as they disappeared in the tree line, I went, and then I just got up, fixed my shirt, and went, what the fuck was that? Like, I wasn't even out of breath. I was, you know, just freaking acting. This became years later when I started developing a program for citizens. I talked about the behavioral psychology of feigning fear and feigning pain to influence behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And it works all the time.
Yeah.
But what happened was I went home. My dad said, hey, how was the game? I said, I just got the shit beaten out of me by two guys. And I don't have a mark on my face. My shirt's not even torn.
Hmm.
But as I blurt out, I just got the shit beaten out of me by two guys. My father's like, you know, I don't remember if he actually said this, but I always imagined he did. Like, he looks at me, goes like, was it a pillow fight? Like, he's like, you have no marks. What do you mean you got beaten up? In my 12-year-old mind, I got the shit beaten out.
Yeah.
And he said, well, and I said, look, I'm not going to school. I'm not going to high school next year. I was like fucking terrorized from it. He said, well, you are going to high school, but you're going to also learn some martial arts. And we found there was only one Taekwondo school open in my area at the time. And I went there so scared of what had happened that it was my safety blanket. I went there and I trained every single day. Within a year, Bruce Lee passed away and we had the big martial art, golden era of martial art, 1973. I fell in love with Bruce Lee. And just was fanatical about it, thinking that, like, that me understanding how to defend myself would help with all my other fears, that there'd be some sort of transformational element to that. An interesting side note also, growing up, I was always fascinated by fighting. So I grew up when, you know, black and white TVs were becoming color TVs, and there were all these action shows, Mannix, The Streets of San Francisco. My favorite show was The Wild Wild West.
Okay.
And these were all like shows where there's always a bad guy and there's always a good guy who always got the girl and always got into a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my grooming in the 60s. So like, if you know how to fight, you get the girl and you win. Right. And so I was always, whenever there was a fight in a TV show, I was there like kids are on their phones these days, like just
glued to it. Yeah.
Just glued to it. And I was fascinated with anything fighting. And that was like literally for years before I actually, so when I started doing the Taekwondo, I was like, oh my God, like why wasn't I doing this before?
Yeah.
And I trained 7 days a week.
I like, the aspect there, like you're bringing in kind of the motivations that got you into it, but also the people that you kind of look up to and I don't know if you say idolize, but you know,
sure,
the ones that kind of set the precedence that make you want to go down that path. Maybe we could talk a bit about, you already brought up mindset and fear. Maybe we'll start with a bit of the fear stuff, because I think this will take up quite a bit of the conversation. One of the things that I've always kind of noticed, and I've done years of martial arts, did Muay Thai, I've been in Taekwondo, did some Kung Fu when I was a little kid, but the most recent stuff was Muay Thai. I always found it the most applicable to my job, like some of the skills. But one of the things that you brought up that I thought was real interesting, so you're talking about these kids that you have this, one of them's kind of holding on to you, the other goes to punch you. But in that fight, you have that nanosecond to think, and you're able to think, oh, when I scream, the other kid had this response, and maybe I should do it again because they're just going to leave if I do that. How is there a way to train that into people, or is that something that you kind of just have to realize on your own? Or maybe third option, I guess, would be, are you just born with that? Like some people are generally better at that than others, because I've noticed this even when I'm doing police tactics, when we're out in the field and we're dealing with somebody and you just got to get them handcuffed, and you can see another officer might be punching the person, and you're just like, I'm kind of comfortable with the level that we're at here. We don't need to throw punches. And you tell the other person, hey, stop doing that. Or, you know, it's just everybody has like such a different read on the same situation.
Right.
So how do you train those quick thoughts into people, if it's even possible?
Yeah, that's a great question, man. So there are a few questions in there, but there, in our training, we talk about a principle called the three I's: instincts, intuition, and intelligence. And let me back up, because you started this off by referencing fear management.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is tied back to fear. Your ability to de-escalate yourself and de-escalate a suspect or the person in front of you. It could be your wife, it could be your husband, it could be a kid, it could be a coworker. Any element of de-escalation, the quality of your de-escalation is proportional to your ability to self-regulate.
Okay.
And that's big fancy trauma-informed speak for, can I control myself? If I can control myself, I have a better chance of controlling somebody else. Again, can I control myself? I then have a better chance of controlling somebody else.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Right? And you know this from being in law enforcement and being in fights. There are some people that no matter what you do, they're going to fight.
Yeah.
There's going to be resistance. That doesn't mean that morally, ethically, legally, you shouldn't still be nice until it's time to not be nice. You know, as the line from the original Roadhouse goes,
yeah,
right? Be nice until it's time to not be nice. It's easy to have these cute maxims, but then you've got like an example where you said, hey, this guy started to wail on this guy, and I was still in the middle of a conversation and thought I could maybe get him to handcuff himself, and then you jump the gun and you overreacted, in my estimation, emotionally. Mm-hmm. I would say, and you could go, well, that guy likes punching. Well, no, like if you're an Aikido guy and then someone else in your team, so you're the Thai guy because you do Thai, and then you got another guy who likes boxing, and then you got another guy who likes using his taser, and then you got, and everyone's standing around. When somebody decides to move, their unconscious bias is going to select the weapon system that they're most comfortable with.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right. And so, but when you go for it, has as much to do with threat discrimination as it does to managing your fear. There are people on your department that if some guy grabs a knife, their gun is out and they're shooting right away. Where someone else might put their hands in a negotiator stance and go, hey, listen, put the knife down, because they know they've got options, or they can, they're reading something. And this is kind of what you were getting at, is that taught, can it be learned? Everything I do, the foundation of everything practical and tactical that we teach, everyone goes through a huge block on our No Fear program, understanding the neural circuitry of fear, understanding how a sudden fear spike affects what you're thinking, which will affect how you're breathing. And that energy has to go somewhere. So if in my mind I'm worrying about being second, maybe I throw the punch first. Right. And so a lot of it has to do with, can I self-regulate, stay in control of myself? And do I have a system that protects me when I'm ambushed? And that's the whole spear system, versus a system when I need to be preemptive.
Okay.
And this is very, very interesting stuff. And there's a glimpse at just how detailed, like a lot of people. So like, I just want to get defensive for a second. There's a lot of people who look at our stuff through the lens of the ego as a competitor. Mm. And I always tell people, stop defending your martial art and learn to defend yourself.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, don't tell me, I'd like to see him do that against me, or, you know, he thinks that this, and I hear that a lot, and I'm going, guys, like, I have done decades of research on violence, fear, and aggression to the point where I'm looking at this stuff almost like as a case study and seeing common threads, whether the guys like, you know, a SWAT guy or the soccer mom, and I'm seeing the same type of physiology, kinesiological movement. And I'm going, well, okay, we need to shape that. But the reaction to the sudden violence, while there's stress inoculation, right? You're exposed to in your job in law enforcement, you're exposed to way more violence and threat and danger than the average person. So you're going to be calmer as you gain more experience.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's noticeable. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's an element of fear management. And the same thing happens to your colleagues. Like, you're on for 15 years and some guy's on. Now he comes to your particular unit and he's been there for a month and he's not used to being this close to people or how things are happening because he came from patrol. And you can see he's like, let's go, like adrenaline dump, going. And anyways, I don't want to get too nerdy with this stuff. But I think the big question is this taught? Is it a gift for some people? I know this from teaching now. This, my formula for teaching is the same whether I'm dealing with a tier one unit or a soccer mom and a bunch of her girlfriends. Mm. What changes is the scenario. They are all taught the psychology of fear is the most important thing for you to learn because, and listen carefully to this, everybody, only the people who manage their fear manage to fight. Hmm. That's a very specific sentence. Only the people who manage their fear manage to fight. I don't say manage the fight because that implies victory.
Manage to fight.
Right. Meaning if we're sitting here, an active shooter comes in and starts shooting and we jump to the floor and hide under our desk, we got to hope we're just not going to be executed.
Yeah.
Right. And so If I'm in a situation where I need to be a courageous bystander, or I gotta do something, I gotta charge the threat, or I gotta make, there's always going to be an element of self-doubt. Like, should I do this? Should I not do this? Mm-hmm. What's some engagement here? What's the political narrative here? What's going on here? You know, we just went through, you know, 3 years of the summer of love and mostly protests, and everybody, and my main business is training cops and military, public safety. Like, these last few years were devastating, you know, for this industry, this community.
Yeah.
Because you just, there was, fear had been so weaponized and propagandized that, you know, and we wouldn't call it fear because we're macho type A personalities, mm-hmm. you know, but then, you know, someone says, hey, everyone's filming you, don't do anything here, just stand there during this mostly peaceful protest. And doesn't matter if people like take a swing at you or spit on you or scream at you, just like, do not do anything.
Yeah, like, definitely fear comes into play at everything you decide to do. And that's whether you're taking up a use of force or just something, a basic action, like, you're not going to cross any line because afraid of physical violence back to you, afraid of the media, the political narrative, whatever it might be. So I'm wondering, like, what's the best way to manage fear then? Is it just like through taking kind of courses to learn how to manage that? Is there a way you can...
The smart ass answers, of course, I've got the secret magic, you know, and training. But the reality is I've been studying. So, you know, it's funny to say this. So with respect to fear and fights in the 90s, I wrote a little piece on, and actually became part of the Street Survival, Caliber Press Street Survival Manual for a long, long time. And it was the concept of the three fights.
Okay.
There are three fights. The first fight is between you and you. Do I have the will, the courage, tenacity, the grit to go through what I'm facing? The second fight is with you and the suspect, the threat in front of you. And the third fight is internal affairs, mainstream media, political narrative. And very often what happens is police agencies, because at a certain level, it's more about the politics, staying in office, your promotion. People will gravitate consciously and unconsciously to figuring out systems that protect themselves in fight three. Mm-hmm. So if I want a system that makes me look good, and I don't want to have use of force complaints, I don't want to get fired or voted out of office because I want to be the mayor one day, and right now I'm just the assistant chief of police. We start to make decisions based on, is this court defensible? How would I articulate this? Not, will this work in fight two when one of my officers is at risk of losing his life?
Well, and it's a good thing you bring that up too, because I remember distinctly on one of our parades, and this is years ago, we had a very high up supervisor come in and tell us, don't punch people in the face. And I remember I had a recruit at the time, and afterwards they're like, why are they telling us not to punch somebody? Like, if it's in the use of force continuum and someone's assaultive or whatever level, I'm going to use force. I said, yeah, and 90% of your senses are in your head. So of course you're going to go for somebody's head. I mean, the fastest way to end the fight, disorient, throw people off your track, whatever it is, you're going to hit them in the face, right? Or the head. And that's likely the way you're going to end the fight quickest. It's not going to be because I kept punching someone in the arm or the leg.
Right.
Right. So they say things because of the optics.
Yeah.
And it's like, but that's not what's necessarily going to keep somebody alive out there. So
well, because that person was worried about their status, role,
yes,
in the political, it had nothing to do with your safety.
Yeah.
And that's the unfortunate thing. So my company has always been only about making the operator safe, mm-hmm. only about making the police officer safe. Even now, we have a program called Spear Care. CARE is the acronym for Comprehensive Aggression Response Education. And it's all for care and services, mental health, hospital. It's all trauma-informed. It's a whole, you know, rebirth of our spear system program. So we've got like a military version, we've got a law enforcement version, and now we've got the Spear Care. And it's the same thing. We, in the 2 years that we've been running it, that the most potent feedback we get is people saying this is the first time they were in a course that was designed to protect us, not the person in crisis.
Yeah.
And they love that. Now they feel like empowered. So when I come in, I remember doing something with NYPD, and they had outlawed the LVNR. They weren't allowed neck restraints.
Okay.
And so I came in and I said, I got to show you how we control the head and control the neck. And they were not allowed to learn that. And I said, well, what if it's the only move that's going to, just the chaos that has happened, it's the only way to put the guy to sleep.
Yeah.
And now you don't know it because it was outlawed because somebody who didn't understand how to teach it taught it to you wrong, or somebody was fighting so hard that it damaged the trachea and windpipe, but you didn't know how to correct that, like clear a malfunction. It's a couple of simple steps that can happen very quickly. And they said, yeah, well, we're just not allowed to do it. And I said, well, is the suspect allowed to do it to you?
Yeah, exactly.
And they said, yeah. I said, so can I show you the counter? And they all looked at me and smiled. Because I said, listen, you better be tried by 12 and carried by 6. I said, I'm going to show you the fucking move.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that if someone goes, hey, did I see you practicing lateral vascular neck restraints? You know that's banned. You can look at him and say, Mr. Blauer was running the course. Showed us the counter for it. So to do the counter, we had to put it on, but it was just to learn the counter. But I wanted them to have the tool in their mind. I wanted the mental blueprint, even though they're told they can't do it.
Yeah.
I asked the same group, is it in your use of force continuum to pick up a rock or a hockey puck or a can of tuna and smash somebody in the head to render them unconscious?
Weapon of opportunity.
Right. And everyone will answer, no, you can't do that. And then I go, what about this scenario? And I describe a scenario where that is the only way you're getting home to see your family. And then they go, well, in that case, I could. Well, I said, that should have been your answer before.
Yeah.
If you've got to flip through your legal jurisprudence to go, if something is justified or unjustified under the circumstances, like that's eating time. And so this is really important. And this all comes back to, Nathan, how do you manage fear? How do you manage fear? Instincts, intuition, intelligence. Boom, and you make those decisions. So we will go back to what you asked me a half hour ago. Hey, when you feigned pain and injury that led to the counter to the full Nelson was screaming, mm-hmm. and pretending that you were dying. I'm not saying that always works. My instincts and my intuition led to the first one because of real fear. The immediate survival data collection that happened right there was, as I screamed, I felt the grip loosen, and my brain, my 12-year-old brain, said, "Do that again."
Yeah.
Is that a Wayne Gretzky moment? Is that a Mozart moment? Like, was that like a special? And I say the Wayne Gretzky moment because like Wayne Gretzky was better than everybody who was already the best, right? Only the best hockey players get into the NHL. And then Wayne Gretzky broke every single record. So there's all these NBA players, and there's Michael Jordan or Kobe. So all the right. There's all these classical players, and then there's Mozart. Am I comparing myself to, am I the Mozart of self-defense? I'm making fun of myself right here. But like I have seen things, and I look at that as my obligation to create a program. In 1993, I was teaching a law enforcement conference called the American Society of Law Enforcement Trainers. Gary Klugowitz is a very famous, he was their chairman. Gary Klugowitz had invited me. He was the chairman. He heard me talking at a high liability conference. And he said, I'm not sure I agree with everything you're saying, but it would be doing a disservice to my brothers in arms to not have you talk at the conference. Hmm. And so I flew to Dallas and I talked, and I was really, we're still friends to this day. I went up to him. I said, you're a strange man. He goes, why? I said, because I'm ostensibly a competitor. He had his own training company.
Okay.
But you saw the need to put me in front of all your peers where you could have just said, whatever, like, why give me a podium? I said, that's so unusual. because type A people are very protective and have a scarcity mindset.
Yeah.
And they're very backstabby, a lot of them. They don't want to see you win. And it was super interesting because there were people just hated me at the conference. And then like a handful came up and went, wow, like, you know, that was really interesting. We're sitting around, there's Gary, who worked in corrections and he was the chairman with some forensic specialist, some other chief of police or whatever. And we're sitting there and they're talking about how many cops get sucker punched, like inside the reactionary gap.
Yeah.
And what could you possibly do about that? And what do you do? And I said, well, part of it is how you guys stand. You know, everyone has their hands down around your kit, like indexing their, you know, their belt so they're ready to get to their gun or their taser or their baton. It's ridiculous. You should have your hands up. Imagine boxing with your hands. Imagine having to box, but you got to start. You got to fight with your hands on your belt line of your shorts. The other guy can have his hands up. So they looked at me. I said, the other thing is you all presume compliance and that changes your reaction time.
Okay.
And they go, they said, presume compliance. What is that? I said, well, you never heard about the theory of presumed compliance? This is a true story, David. I go, you never heard about the theory of presumed compliance? They go, no, never. You know, I've been a cop for 20 years. I never heard about that. Oh, well, that's because I just made it up right now. And they all started laughing. And they said, what is that? I said, when you've got a badge on and a gun, and I say, don't move, I presume you're going to comply.
Yeah.
And when you move, it's a glitch in the matrix. When you move, I'm going, what the fuck's this? I just told the guy not to move. Conversely, if I say, show me your hands and you don't, I repeat it. Show me your hands. I said, show me your hands. Sir, do you have any weapons on you? Show me your hands. You get sucked into that. The suspect is controlling your behavior and your mind.
Yes.
And so I'm explaining this to them. You should have seen them. It was like they were leaning forward, asking me questions. And I'm like, how do they not know all this stuff? Like, I'm a Canadian that I developed my high gear suit. I had a prototype. And that's why I drove. Gary was the keynote speaker at a high liability conference in Toronto. And I drove there because the Macho company that was making the Redman suit, I wanted them to manufacture for me. That didn't end up happening. But they said, go to this conference and talk to Gary Klugwitz. So I went to the conference there and we talked for like hours. And he said, I got to put you in front of like all my peers at the American Society of Law Enforcement Trainers. That's really what kickstarted my law enforcement career.
Oh, okay.
But it's a fascinating thing because there was a whole bunch of nuances to what I said, but that conversation, Gary looked at me and said, would you write an article on the theory of presumed compliance? And I stayed up all night that night and wrote something. It's one of the most famous articles. I've written hundreds and hundreds of articles now. I've been at SWAT Magazine and Caliber Press and all this shit.
Yeah.
But you should link that for your cops. There's two of them out on Caliber Press. There's two versions, the original and then an updated one. But it's called The Theory of Presumed Compliance. And it's so powerful because any officer that has been thwarted, meaning the suspect got away through some devious maneuver, maimed, injured, maimed, or killed, there was presumed compliance. If it was inside the reactionary gap.
Yeah, I've kind of referred to that as like the power of the patch. Like people get to a scene and they just think, you know, I'm the police and why don't people listen to me? Like, well, most people don't listen to you, but they just get stuck in that loop of like, I'm just going to keep repeating myself. It's almost like, I don't know why they're not listening. And you see it all the time in training. You see it all the time on the street. People just repeating. It's like, okay, I'm pretty sure the person's heard you by the second time you screamed it at them from 5 feet away. Like, try something different, right? And it's how do you manage yourself, like you're saying, the first fight is with you, and how are you managing that, I guess. I think you're one of the few people I've ever seen talk about fear, and you have some very unique ways of describing these processes. I highly recommend, like a lot of people need to go check out your website, see what's on there. There's lots of video clips. Yeah, I'm blown away by a lot of the talk here. It's some very distinct stuff that it's funny, like you're saying, you've been talking about it 30 plus years and, you know, people are just starting to realize some of this now. So hopefully you get the credit you deserve for a lot of it. There's lots that we haven't even got to because I got a million questions for you. But I want to talk about some of your ventures, most notably, I guess. I want to ask about the podcast.
Sure.
Because, you know, obviously it relates to this. But, you know, you've got a lot of things going on. What's kind of the one that occupies the most time for you right now? And do you have like a favorite of what you're doing now?
So, yeah, my favorite stuff is actually my tactical garage gym.
Okay.
So this was something that was spun at the height of COVID as a way for me to kind of unify the world. There's, you know, I've been around for decades, as we identified. And there's a lot of people that want to train with me and they just can't. Hey, I'm semi-retired from active teaching. And when I say that, I don't mean I'm not physical anymore. I just came back from 3 days of seminars. I leave on Sunday to go teach again. So I'm still teaching, but I'm teaching with very select groups that have discretionary funds that are bringing me in. They want to overhaul their system, or they know they're missing the no fear or the fear system. Like, you know, if you think about it, the no fear teaches the how do you manage fear, which is necessary in all types of de-escalation. And, you know, getting in a gunfight is a form of de-escalation, right?
Yep.
So, you know, like you could metaphysically look at this as I de-escalated this because I had to stop the threat because he was, you know, trying to kill us, right? So I still teach, but I've got a training team, and I've got, you know, people that represent our research in Australia, in the UK, in Holland, in all over the USA, and then of course we travel all over the world. So when COVID hit, everything got locked down, and a lot of people knew that they couldn't train with me unless they went to our flagship event, which is our combatives camp we hold every year. We've been doing that for like 15 years now. And so I started this thing called the Tactical Garage Gym. And what that was I've got, you know, like a gym adjacent to my office here, you know, Bob dummies and striking stuff and all sorts of stuff. And I teach the spear system, the mindset, the fear management. We do like every week, like this week, we've got a specific course for first responders. Happens, once a week. It's a first responder only course. It's an hour with me on Zoom, and we take, like this week, we looked at the murder of a police officer that was, you know, body cam was released and surveillance CCTV was released, and just like turn it into like scenario training. And I have a very unique methodology of breaking down scenarios that I've been teaching that for about 22 years. And it's how do you break down body cam, helmet cam, dashboard video.
Okay.
How do you scenario training? And there's six different stages to it. And there's all these phase on how do you catalog every pre-contact indicator. You know, when would you move? How do you insert the startle response here? How do you make this a more tactical response? Blah, blah, blah. And we go through these drills, and it works. You can drop any scenario into that. So you ask me, what's my favorite stuff? It's actually, I teach four times a week on Zoom to people who can't get to me because of geography or because of finances.
Yeah.
You know, so if you booked me for a day, like only corporations or organizations could pay my day rate. But here you can train with me for like you can train live with me.
Yep.
For the cost of a fancy cappuccino in a high end, like, so here for $6-7, you can actually be in a class with me. You're on Zoom. Now, some people, I just want to point this out. Some people go, I'm sick of Zoom. I'm not teaching my Zoom, but you can't, if you want to get this information at an affordable rate, like this is the option, right?
Yes.
You know,
It's hard to host a lot of people at a facility, right? Everyone's got to book hotels and food and stuff. Like, yeah, it's a commitment.
But also, like, for example, let's say you come to my Vegas event this year in July. You go, I was really interested in joining and come there. So you fly there from Edmonton. You know, that costs you $600. Mm-hmm. You know, everything's 30 to 50% more expensive post-COVID for no reason at all.
Yeah.
You know, The hotel room you used to get for $79 is now $179. And you're there for, you know, 3-4 days, and you spend. So now you're like, and then you pay for the camp for the 2 days of training, and it's cool, but you just spent like $2,000.
Yes.
You know, where you could train with me for 2 years for $2,000.
Yeah.
Like if you signed up. Now, what's interesting about our garage gym is it's literally the largest repository of realistic and relevant self-defense in the world. Up in the cloud, you can go in there once you're a member and go active shooter, ground fighting, the fear management, and the search function inside the vault will show you all the classes we did where like that language was used.
Very cool.
And so, you know, and I bring this up. It's you ask me what am I most excited about? I love doing my No Fear podcast. I love teaching. I love doing podcasts like this. But the most fun I have every week. Yesterday, I taught 2 classes. Friday, I have a class. I teach Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And it'll be, I don't have to look at a spreadsheet. I don't have to answer an email. I don't have to get on a sales call. I go into my garage, freaking warm up, and then I practice violence. And I practice managing violence. And I empower and I inspire people. And we have cops, firefighters, nurses, martial artists, like people who accidentally you know, saw a story on Instagram and went, who is this guy? And then like, so like raw beginners, because it's recorded in first person as if you had booked me for a private lesson.
Yeah.
So you just see me, you're not there. You don't even know, you know, you don't know that there's 100 people on a call or 10 people on a call or one person on a call. It looks like Tony Blauer is giving you a lesson
one-on-one
in spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we take the coolest thing, Nathan, is we take current video, like something that's gone viral, and, you know, go like, shit, let's break this down and go, what would we have done if we were in the room? You know, like what, you know, what is this? And, you know, there's tactical fitness components and there's, you know, it's pretty, it's the most fun I have.
I think one of the things that I like the most about what I see from your products and from the videos and stuff is it's a lot of stuff, like for me anyways, it's things I've always kind of thought of, but I've never been able to put words to it. And you have a way of like kind of putting the words to it and giving, you know, an explanation of like, well, why are you thinking that? Or how did you think like that? And what's the process you're going through? So for me, that's the biggest takeaway. I think a lot of people would get that out of this too. I do want to ask about the No Fear podcast because I've been crushing these over the last few weeks and in lead up to doing this. You get some awesome guests on there. You know, anybody could check this out. It's on Spotify. You could do the videos on YouTube as well. But yeah, like there's a lot of names that people will recognize. One of them I wanted to ask specifically about was Rob Ingram from the McDojo Life.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think everybody who knows McDojo. Have you ever been called out as like, has anyone ever challenged your systems, called you a fraud?
Of course.
Has that ever come up?
Time.
Yeah. There's always haters.
Yeah. All the time. Not all the time. I shouldn't say all the time. But I mean, consistently that has happened to the point where, you know, Black Belt posted a quote of mine, Black Belt Magazine on their page, and two guys commented, who is this old guy? Never seen him in octagon, you know, looks like a jerk, you know, like, you know, and I'm like, you read that and the 24-year-old Tony wants to go punch them in the throat. and the 60-year-old Tony is like, I'm more of a poet philosopher than I am a businessman. Cause a lot of that shit gets under my skin.
Mm-hmm.
Just for a second, I got like my first reaction will go through like this. The first thing I go, the fuck is with people?
Yeah.
What the fuck? And I go, like, I've been studying violence longer than you've been alive.
Yeah.
Just before you open your trap and let people know how stupid you are.
Yeah.
Why don't you do some research. There's lots of people. There are some well-known people that go, spear is bullshit and Blauer is a fraud.
Hmm.
And I'm like, and they're And they're well known people. And I'm like, and I just don't even know what to say to them, because like countries, Department of Defense's, countries hire me to come in and train them.
Yeah.
Are you saying that these guys at Fort Bragg and these guys at the Marine Corps and these guys at the FBI and these guys in Australia and these six different, I'm trying to think of the right name to describe them without saying who they are, just for, because I never mentioned specific organizations, but like the equivalent of State Department, like a different,
yeah.
You'd say they're so stupid. They're so stupid that my Instagram post made them go, let's bring this guy in. Like,
yeah.
Like, it's like, and I'm a sarcastic prick. So like, I want to go, why can't you just say you're sick of people going, have you heard of Tony Blauer? What do you think of the spear system? Because that's all it is. If it wasn't about ego and market share, you would give a shit.
Yeah.
Like if you weren't worried about me taking a training dollar from you because of losing a contract, you know, it'd be like, you know, me saying, Nathan, well, you know, what do you think about the Space Force?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you're going, those guys are assholes. You're going, like, I'm a cop in Edmonton. I don't give a fuck about Space Force.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Well, I don't think you have to really answer to any of those people, because your body of work speaks for itself. You have enough big names and other people that do back your work. So yeah, I think the critics.
But it is bizarre. It's you know, one of my fatal flaws as a human is I'm so obsessed with making good people safer that I take it personally when somebody won't even investigate the body of work.
Yeah.
But it's not like I need these people to go, Tony is number one. I don't need anything. I'm just like my buddy, Tim Larkin.
Yep.
So as his own system, we both want the same thing for our students. We want them to avoid violence. And if push comes to shove, we need them to be safe and get home to their family. Tim's approach, his actual, like the psychomotor approach, there's some overlap, but it's very different than mine. But I love Tim. Tim loves me. Do you, Tim? Like, we've both been in each other's podcast numerous times. Mm-hmm. We both talk to each other. We get together. When I'm in Vegas, I go to, like, you know, lunch with him. We hang out. There's no, Tim got a gig or Tim did this. Or it's like, it's just bizarre, right? Where you don't get, and if you've been around martial arts a lot, you understand, but you understand this is a martial symptom and it's tied to insecurity and ego. What do you give a shit if I'm making people safer and some people like the way I do it, you know?
Well, and you gotta have, I guess, you'd have a pretty sad life if you wake up every day thinking like, boy, I really hate those people who are making money, or I hate those people who got this job. It's like, don't you have better things to worry about in life? Maybe just work harder or do something different to get ahead, right?
Oh, it's weird. It's a self-awareness problem. And and they don't say that, Nathan. If they did say that, they might go, why am I even thinking that? But it's that whole thing of like, you know, living rent-free in somebody's head where I don't think about it. They obviously think about me.
Oh.
You know, but there's some like really big names that I've gone out of their way to try and discredit me. I'm like, why? And the only reason you could, if you've never trained with me and spent any time with me, you know, here's the interesting thing. Ron Don Vito, former Marine, developed the line system. When he left the Marines, he moved to Fayetteville and was running the Q course for the U.S. Army.
Okay.
Highly regarded. He's got fucking hands this big, scary, lifelong martial artist. One of his students discovers my stuff, falls in love with it. But he's in at the time he was in seventh group. And I'm down there working with the big boys down at Fort Bragg. And he hears I'm in town and we go out to lunch. And he says, you got to meet Ron Don Vito. And I go, he's the guy that did the line system. He goes, you know, you guys would really get along. And I'm going, well, I don't know. I have a lot of, you know, people who are competing for the same training dollar, like it's an awkward meeting. He goes, no. So he sets up this meeting, we get together and we talk till like 3 a.m. for 5 hours. But it starts off with very blunt. He says, why are you teaching people to flinch? I just don't understand why you would do that. And I said, I'm not teaching anyone to flinch.
He clearly didn't look it up.
he like anyone else, you have like if you're a jiu-jitsu guy and I go, hey, some guy sees you take money out of an ATM and you're walking away, you just put the money in your pocket. And he goes, give me your fucking money. And you're a jiu-jitsu guy. You're not thinking about a liver shot or a round kick to the head. You're thinking, if we fight, I can take this guy to the ground. I'm going to choke him out.
Yeah.
Change the scenario. You're a boxer who just left the ATM. Same scenario. Give me your money. You're not thinking about a back kick or a double leg. You're thinking about a body shot, an uppercut. You're going, if we fight, I'm going to light this fucker up.
Yeah.
Right? And so everyone who studies and falls in love with a martial art creates a romantic relationship with that martial art. They create an unconscious bias for the moves that work for them. But here's the thing that people don't realize, and this is the neuroscience of the spear system and the neuroscience of our training methodology. When you do something over and over again, and you are approaching your proverbial 10,000 hours of doing something, and you got really good at it, you're not just creating a romantic relationship and an unconscious bias for that, because why would you try something in a high-risk situation that you weren't good at?
Yeah.
You would never select that. But the most important thing from a neuroscience perspective is you've created neural patterns. You've created a myelinated sheath that improves the signal speed to the neuron that fires the neuromuscular command through these neural patterns and motor engrams. There's no such thing as muscle memory in the way people use that term. Mm-hmm. It's all neural patterns. So in a high-stress situation, you, as the expression goes, you default to the level of your training, which means you go to the stuff that you can trust.
Yes.
And if the safest thing to do in a situation was to run, disengage, barricade, if that decision, the refractory delay between stimulus response is a fixed amount of time, you want it to be as fast as possible. We want mind speed. I have a maximum. I actually do a talk called Violence Loves Speed. Mm-hmm. And in this talk I do for like a capabilities talk, I do different commands and organizations called Violence Loves Speed. I talk about the speed of violence. I go, you don't counter the speed of violence by drawing faster, kicking faster, blocking faster, because the mind navigates the body. You improve your chances in the Violence Loves Speed metaphor by improving mind speed. And you improve mind speed by learning how to think fast. Of course, something you asked me earlier. And you think fast by clearing fear. So metaphorically, fear, psychological fear, is like a stovepipe.
Yeah.
In a pistol, right? And so here I am. I pull my gun. I get ready to engage. I pull a shot off. I get a stovepipe right away, but I don't notice it. I'm committed. I'm in a good stance. I'm a tactical athlete. I'm ready to engage. I'm ready to go. And my gun goes click, click. So even though I want to get in the gunfight, there's something jamming me from everything working. And it's just a metaphor that we've got to clear our fear to engage, whether we're using something kinetic or using something, like empty hand. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what it is. The mind navigates the body. And this comes back to the whole fear management component.
You know what? You're spot on. And that's a stuff that actually, I wanted to ask that we didn't get to, but I've actually kept you way over time, and I apologize for that. And I could talk to you for hours more. Just want to wrap up here. I just want to give you the opportunity to just tell people, where's the best place to follow you? So you have the website, I'll throw that up.
Yep.
Social media, anything else that you want people to kind of go check out?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on all the places. If you're on LinkedIn, there's a Tony Blauer on LinkedIn. If you're on Twitter, I'm on Twitter. I post most frequently on LinkedIn and my personal Instagram page. It's just at Tony Blauer. If you want to find out more about all the things that my company does, go to our blauertrainingsystems.com.
Okay.
That shows the four verticals in my company. We've got force on force training equipment that revolutionized the training. And we have a Canadian distributor with Setcan, so they carry it. You know, it's got a division for the spear system, which shows all the different training arms inside a spear. So we got stuff for the general public, we got stuff for cops, we got stuff for military, stuff for, you know, the, you know, care and services, healthcare stuff. Then I've got, you know, a coaching component and our whole No Fear program. And I would tell all of you listening to this, you know, there's no such thing as no fear, N-O, but there is fear. And when you get to no fear, it changes how fast you convert. And so mind speed, if you're in real estate, how fast you can manage fear. If you're in the stock market, if you're, you know, you're sitting in a bar and you're single and you're going, oh, wow, I think that girl or that guy's looking at me. I think we've got some chemistry, and you have fear. So you order another drink and you wait. Well, if you wait too long, someone else is dancing with her.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's like, and you know, this is the same thing. You fear creates doubt, doubt creates hesitation, hesitation creates procrastination. When you understand how to manage fear, you affect how long you procrastinate on anything. And, you know, yeah, since most of your followers are in public safety and law enforcement, procrastination in a fist, knife, or gunfight could be a big problem.
Yes. Well, we're trying to keep people safe, keep them alive, get them back home. Just to hang on the line for 2 seconds, I'll say bye offline, but I'll remind people, share, like, follow, get the message out there. And we're just trying to help people out. So remember to do all those things, and we will talk to you next time.